And welcome to the Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler, talking about world money, investing. You know, there are a lot of things that cause people to get really bad results around their finances. A lot of it's behavior related. Behavior is the big deal. You know, sometimes it's in, and like I said, I'm going to spend some time in this in the third hour, the behavior that is driving people not to save as much as they should or spend on things they probably shouldn't be spending on. That's going to be one of the behaviors. And, you know, the reality is that America, we got it pretty good. We got it pretty good compared to the rest of the world. I often bring people through an exercise where I have them put their income and show them where they are in a calculator and show them where they are in comparison to the rest of the world, and it usually stuns them. You know, but still in all, people don't do very well when it comes to retirement planning. A lot of it's behavior related due to just kind of the junk that we got in our brains that we've programmed in our brains, or that people, our friends and family, and just that we live life in with so much information coming at us and so many things that bias us and cause us distress and cause us not to do what we probably know what we should do. And it's often we use this example that it's kind of like the diet and exercise industry. You know, we know what we should do, but doing it is a totally different deal. And that's why coaching and walking alongside and having somebody just help keep you on the track is such a big deal. It's the biggest deal. And, you know, a lot of times the investment industry, what I find is they major in the minors. You know, should I do a Roth conversion? Should I not do it? And I think that stuff's important. We do that. We talk to people about that stuff all the time. You know, should I do a Roth? Should I not do a Roth conversion? You know, how do you take, the order of distribution from investments? Yeah, it's all important stuff. It's all important stuff, but the bigger deal has to do with behavior. If you look at the difference in return of investors, for example, you know, versus the markets historically, it's not even close. I mean, it's awful. You know, we look at the level of a value increase in the average investor in a stock mutual fund, and it's abysmal versus the markets. And we're talking about in the neighborhood of, oh gosh, I don't even know. It's I'd have to take a stab. I didn't even think about it this way, but I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 times or something like that over 30 years or something crazy like that. A very, very high difference between how much investors have accumulated their money to versus what markets grew to. It may be something like eight times. I can't remember exactly. I ought to look that up before the end of the hour and tell you exactly what it is, because I have the number on my computer. It's just not coming to me right off the top of my head. So let's just talk a little bit, though, about one of the things that I think is fascinating regarding what's going on right now, and that is it was actually highlighted in an article in Investment News, and it was talking about investor flight. And they said that the investor flight is the biggest since the collapse of Lehman. I thought, wow, really? I read this. It's from Bloomberg News. It says, investors haven't been this bearish since the collapse of the Lehman Brothers. Now, I often have this philosophy. If investors are running from the stock market, I sort of go, cool. You know, I don't mean it's good. I don't like to watch people, you know, put themselves in pain. But typically, it's a good indicator that, you know, that maybe the end of a bear market is over. Or you know, so a lot of markets right now, you look at the past 5 years and you know, 10 years, and you go, well, no, market's been really, really good. And then, no, well, one area of the market's been really, really good. Other areas are okay, like small value and you know, the smaller companies and large value, it's okay internationally. It's okay. I mean, there have been positive returns, but nowhere near market history, nowhere market norms over that, you know, over history. So what's making people bearish right now, though, is just this whole cloud over, you know, Brexit and Trump impeachment and investigations and recession fears and the election coming up. There are a lot of things that are causing people to be very, very nervous. And, here's why, when I see this type of activity and this type of nervousness, that I kind of go, all right, this is kind of good. Because when people are scared, and I love what Warren Buffett basically said. He said, you know, he said he gets, well, I don't like the way he says it. He says, you know, get greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. But, you know, the point is made that, you know, people typically, when they're the most fearful, that's when the returns typically end up being historically the highest going forward. Because to get you to put your money to work, somebody's going to have to offer you their stock at a lower price. And in essence, that is when risk is transferred. You're taking risk on, so you end up paying a lower price for stocks because you want to get a higher return because you're taking on the risk that the other person is abandoning. And, you know, we look at the stock market, and as another great Warren Buffett quote goes, that, you know, people look at the stock market and they go, oh, it's a gambling casino, oh, it's scary. And he goes, you know, no, it's a mechanism for transferring money from people who aren't willing to take risk to people who are willing to take risk. Because literally, it's a wealth transfer. And if you look at history as to when most of the wealth is transferred, it's when people have been the most scared. And, you know, there are investors out there, right, though, that are really, really, and they call it irrationally bullish. And they were talking about one big investment group, and they said, we're actually irrationally bullish, you know, which I think is kind of a funny term, you know, irrational exuberance versus irrational bullishness. But, you know, you look at areas of the market right now, and I'm just going to give you some numbers to think about. When I buy stocks, I'm buying the companies, I'm buying the earnings of the companies, and I'm buying the rights to the book value of the company too, because I own the assets of the company. You know, I own their land, I own their machinery, their equipment, their, you know, I own all of their stuff too. You got to think about it both ways, but I also get rights to the earnings of the companies as well. If we look right now at history and we say, well, historically, what are U.S. big companies selling for? About $2.40. What are they selling for now? About $3.18. You know, so people aren't, they don't seem to be terribly scared about big U.S. companies right now, apparently. International is about $1.54. That's way the heck lower. International, so a lot of people are a little bit nervous about international. Now they're buying for less than half what U.S. companies are selling for. If you look at U.S. small value companies, they're selling for $1.08. International small value, 75 cents on the dollar. If you look at large value companies, $1.69. International value, 90 cents. That's according to Morningstar this morning. And, that's one thing that's going on right now. Now, just to give you an idea right here, I talk about indexing, and I ran these numbers too just for the fun of it, because I'm not a great fan of index. We don't index portfolios. The only area of the market that I'll have an index fund in my own portfolio in is large U.S. stocks, and that's not even a true index. It actually doesn't have the same problems of trading that an index fund has, which is when the index changes, they go and sell a bunch of stocks at that point in time and buy a bunch of new ones. So in essence, they don't make that faux pas. They're a little bit smarter about how that's managed. But, you know, indexing works pretty well in that particular area, large U.S. stocks. If you look at the value, though, and I've often talked about how it doesn't work as well in small and small value, I just decided to run the area of the market that I have in large value, it's $1.69. Well, the index, the matching index for those of you that are clients, and you will know what I'm talking about here, the Russell 1000 value, it's at $1.93. That's a 14% difference. So the index is 14% higher. And then you look at small value, it's $1.08 versus $1.25, and that's a 16% difference. You know, if you look at, you know, then this question came up because we often benchmark international companies, small international companies versus the Europe, Australia, Far East small index. Right now, that area of the market's selling for $1.32 versus the fund I benchmark against, which is the what I own, at 75 cents. That's a 76% difference. So, you know, those of you that have asked the questions, and you know who you are, where I say, you know, that if it's not going to match the benchmark directly, that's part of the reason that it doesn't match the benchmark directly, because there is no such thing as an international small value index. But the point here is this. all those numbers that I named for you, you know, 75 cents and $1.69 and $1.08 versus 318 in large U.S. stocks are very, very low numbers. So in effect, what we're seeing is some of this nervousness built into prices. And that's why I look at it and go, I don't really worry when people are getting nervous. I don't get antsy. I don't want to jump out. I don't want to do anything differently. Matter of fact, I get a little tinge of hope, which sounds weird, just simply because the market doesn't, it isn't falling on deaf ears, this negative stuff that's going on out there. I mean, you see some of these headlines, they'll scare the living daylights out of you. I saw one this morning, more than a third of millennials polled approve of communism. And I said to my son, I says, hey, what do you think of that? What do you think of that? And, Alex, what do you think? And he goes, I don't necessarily believe the polls. And I said, why? And he gave me one. He gave me an example of one that was just dead on. And, you know, the way they did the poll, it was, you could tell where they would get really skewed data through the way they did the poll. And the other thing they said, which I think was smart, he says, yeah, they'll grow out of it. Yeah, my 22-year-old son, you know, the wisdom coming out of his mouth. They'll grow out of it and raise a child up in the way he should go, right? but you know, there was a new survey released by Washington D.C. nonprofit Victim of Communism Memorial Foundation, and they're getting a little bit nervous about this kind of stuff, and they're saying, you know, that with capitalism among widening divide between haves and have-nots been plunged in popularity from a year ago. And there are 70% of millennials said that they likely vote socialist. Now, why is it that I don't get scared to death as an investor? Well, there was a really interesting study in academic circles where they looked at returns in socialist governments in socialist economies versus returns in stock markets in more capitalist economies. And because there was less risk in the capitalist economy to the company, the returns were actually higher in more socialist economies, which sounds totally weird until you realize that risk and return are related. And I know, as I've said many times before, if companies look at it and go, you're coming down onto us too hard, A, they're going to find ways around it. I've given examples of how, you know, where Warren Buffett gave that one example, how two companies were lending to each other in order to avoid taxes on repatriating cash back to the United States. And it was just a brilliant move. And that there was just a great way of sidestepping all of the taxes. They're not idiots. They're not just going to sit there and take it. And, you know, the reality of it is that when a politician comes in and says, I'm going to get you, big company, and we're going to take you to the cleaners, a big company goes, yeah, give it your best shot. Give it your best shot. But, you know, in reality, we got to look at this and go, you know, just this is a quality of life type of an issue. And he had a great quote, this guy who was the executive director of Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation that everybody ought to memorize. He says the historical amnesia about the dangers of communism and socialism is on full display in this year's report. He said in a statement on Monday, he says, when we don't educate our youngest generations about the historical truth of 100 million victims murdered at the hands of communist regimes over the past century, we shouldn't be surprised at their willingness to embrace Marxist ideas. I mean, that is just dead on it. And I was talking to a young lady couple weeks ago, and we had this conversation, and she goes, I think, you know, look at, and she started talking about Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, and I said, hey, you add up the value of all those companies in those countries, and it comes to less than 2% of the value of countries worldwide, A. B, I said, when a country has a system where people are paid to take out a mortgage, negative interest rates, they're paid to take out a mortgage, their economy isn't necessarily everything you think it is. You know, it's not really all that great. Now, the reality of it is, if it's interesting, because if you look at markets, stock markets in these countries, back to investing, because I'm always trying to balance these two things with you guys. But if you look at markets, some of the highest returns have been in those countries. Why? Because they're huge risks. And investors demand high returns when there's more risk. We do a workshop where actually we go back through history and walk through and kind of, you know, jokingly say, you know what, nobody was begging me for Swedish stocks in, you know, this year. And I forgot what year it was, but, you know, there were like 80% returns or something crazy like that. But the point is this, you know, as an investor, I'm not just going to sit there and take it. And companies aren't just going to sit there and take it. They're going to figure out ways to adapt to whatever's happening. You know, and you look at Berkshire Hathaway, you know, the Buffett, what's he doing right now? He's sitting on a big cash pile. Why? He's looking at it going, I don't see any attractive, and he mainly focuses on big companies. That's what he likes to buy, is larger companies. He's just sitting on a pile of cash. And, you know, for me, I don't sit on a pile of cash because I don't have the ability to buy a company and turn it around like he does, obviously. You know, so that's not, and you don't either. But, you know, you look at Buffett, what he's doing, and but here's the point about that. What's he doing? Sitting on a pile of cash rather than buying large U.S. stocks. What are investors doing? What I've been saying the past several weeks, they've been piling in to large U.S. stocks. What is Buffett doing? I'm not going to necessarily go there, he says. You know, so, and why is it that people have been doing that? It's because of recent historic past performance. People chase returns over and over and over again, and it comes back to bite them. You can't chase returns. You can't look at track record of funds and look at historical records of mutual funds and go, this fund did really, really good. I think I'm going to go put my money there. Because sure as anything, you're going to buy, and all of a sudden that area of the market's going to turn around. And just look at those numbers I gave you. $3.18 versus U.S. small value at $1.08. I mean, that's literally just shy of 3 times less. Now, I'm not saying either one of those prices are wrong. That one is mispriced and the other one's overpriced and the other one's underpriced. I'm just telling you there are big differences. And when we talk about markets being overvalued all over the place, I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing it when I look at different asset categories around the world. That is why I preach and I will continue to talk about diversify, diversify, diversify. You know, make sure that you don't put all your eggs in any one basket. Make sure you're, you know, don't get pulled in, sucked in by, you know, as an advisor, you know, my mutual fund's made this much return. This fund has done this. Why don't you own this fund? Don't get sucked into that. That's literally what has caused so much heartache historically for investors. Look at the data. Look at how I started this hour talking about the average investor versus the stock market. It's no mistake that the average investor has underperformed the stock market by 7 to 8% per year. Why? Because they make these same mistakes over and over again. And if I have anything to say about it, I'm going to stop it. I am going to do as much as I can to prevent it. And, you know, those of you who listen to the show, bless you, because, you know, you won't be the ones that are sucked in by this stuff. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show, right here on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. Another one of those topics that has been coming up, which has something to do with the election. A lot of people asking about Roth conversions lately. Concerned that tax rates are going to be higher in the future. Pay taxes right now. You know, this is something I tell people, be really super, super careful about. There was an article that Ed Slott had done in regards to this in Investment News. He's a big IRA expert. Does a lot of this kind of, a lot of teaching to financial people around the country about this. And he was talking about one of the most confusing things that people are confused about Roth IRA conversions. And, you know, they're pretty simple. If you're, let's say that, you know, you're, you have a Roth IRA, you got this 5-year rule. And if you've held it for 5 years, and if you're over 59 and a half years old, and you've done a conversion to a Roth IRA from a regular IRA, you know, so you go pay the taxes. A lot of times people will convert to a Roth. They take $10,000. They move it over to the Roth IRA, for example, pay taxes on the 10 grand. and let's say the taxes are $2,000, just to use a nice round number. Then they take $2,000 out of their savings and pop it into the Roth IRA. So in essence, you're moving money from taxable non-qualified accounts into your IRA by doing that. You know, so it's kind of a nice little deal if it makes sense from a financial perspective. And that can be debatable as to whether it'll make sense from a financial perspective, and I'll talk about more about that in just a second. But if you're over 59 and a half, it's pretty easy because then all your distributions are tax and penalty free forever, and including distributions to the beneficiaries. It's all tax and penalty free, and that's what a lot of people are looking at. Well, gee, if the tax rates go up, you know, probably ought to pay taxes right now because the tax rates are much lower. And there are a lot of people, you know, thinking that that may be a good idea. Now, before I get into that, he gave a couple examples where a lot of people get confused, which I thought was, you know, probably apropos. He says, you know, first 5-year clock only applies under age 59 and a half. You know, there are two clocks that he talks about, he calls them penalty-free distributions from Roth conversions. When a traditional IRA is converted to a Roth, the account owners who are under age 59 must wait 5 years before they can take penalty-free distributions of funds that were taxable when converted. And, you know, for an example, let's say you had a guy that was 30 years old, and he converted his traditional IRA to a Roth, and what would happen is the IRS is going to go back to, let's say he did it in September. They're going to go back to January that year, and they're going to say that's where the clock starts, the 5-year clock. As January of the year that he did the conversion, he's got to wait 5 years, and then he's going to take a penalty-free distribution of the converted assets. Now, if he withdraws any of the converted funds before the 5-year period is up, the distribution is going to be it will be tax-free, but subject to a 10% penalty. And here's what's going on, is when you do a conversion from an IRA to a Roth IRA and you're that young, the government looks at it and says, you're trying to get out of that 10% early withdrawal penalty for IRAs. You know, that's all you're doing by converting. You're thinking that you're going to get around it and you're going to trick us. And they're like, nah, you're not going to trick us that easily. So what they do is they say, okay, we're going to hit you with a 10% penalty if you do it before the 5-year period is up. Now, if he withdraws the funds after that 5-year period, even though he's only going to be just 35 years old in this particular case, because they're using an example that the guy was, he was 30 when he started it, that he'll have access to his converted assets tax-free and penalty-free. Now, that's only the converted assets, though. So if he converts $10,000 over, you can always, and this is something I find that people don't typically understand. When you make contributions, let's say you just start off a regular old Roth IRA and you put money in and you're under 59 and a half, you can always get at, with just regular contributions to a Roth, at the principal, what you put in. It's the gain that gets taxed and penalized if you pull it out early. You know, so that's what you got to be conscious of, is that. And you know, you just got to make sure that you've got that down, because you can get at the principal, and sometimes people will do that. They'll use it for things. I had a guy that was having some problems, and he needed money early, and it was interesting because the IRS said, no, you can't do that. You got a penalty on that. And I says, no, you fight this. And he fought it, and he won. You know, so sometimes you'll find that the IRS doesn't necessarily know the rules regarding that, and you know, that's why you just got to be aware of this stuff. You just never know. So the Roth IRA, back to this. So here's the thing to think about. You know, when I look at the tax rates, you know, people are concerned that we're going to go back to a 15% tax bracket where we have, you know, the 12 right now, and you know that we're going to go up in tax rates there. The biggest jump is right now between 12 and 22% brackets. Then you got these little incremental brackets, you know, that, so it's 22 and it goes to 24, and they're just small jumps. You got to think about, number one, is there a big difference between what you're likely to be taxed when you pull the money out versus right now? If we go back to a 15% bracket, you know, it's not, and right now you're in a 24% tax bracket, and you're going and converting your Roth at a 24% tax bracket just because you think tax rates are going to go up. Well, they may go up, but who are they typically targeting? Very, very high income people. They're not typically looking to raise taxes in any kind of a meaningful way on people in a 12% tax rate or 15. You know, let's say that rate does go back up to 15. You look at that, it's still kind of low, and it's still well lower than the 24 that you'd be paying taxes on right now to do the conversion. The other thing you got to be really conscious of, and that is there's almost no end to Washington's greed. And I laughingly say that, but you know, there's somebody who's talking to me. I forgot who it was this week. We were talking about some of these countries overseas and how these people are paying 60-70% taxes on their income. And I was like, good night. And he says, well, because of a lot of it being the consumption taxes over there. And I've talked about that a lot, where you also have taxes on goods. So you got income taxes, then you got taxes on goods that are sold, and like a national sales tax, you think of it that way, or value-added taxes, and you look at how sneaky that stuff is, because it's just part of the expense. You know, when you go to some of these foreign countries, and they'll say, hell, these people are living high on the hog, they got higher incomes than us. Well, their cost of living is way the heck higher than us, because of those taxes. You know, so in reality, it's not necessarily all that great. Now, if I have gone and converted my Roth into my IRA to a Roth, and I pay a bunch of taxes, and then all of a sudden we end up having to pay these other taxes on top, you know, consumption taxes, then I look at it and go, maybe this wasn't such a great idea. You know, because sometimes to sell this kind of stuff, what they'll do is they'll say, hey, we'll put a consumption tax in, but we'll lower your income tax rate. And then, of course, what happens, the income tax rate ends up going a little bit higher in the future. And it's just frustrating. You just got to outthink the government many times when it comes down to it. So this is something we look closely at. But when I'm doing planning, I'm not just looking at, hey, what are they going to do? What if they do? I'm looking at it as, what else could they do? Where could they sneak in the back door with more taxes? That's another thing that I'm often thinking about regarding this. You know, are there estate taxes that we may be dealing with, or consumption taxes? You know, there are bills out there talking about the required minimum distribution, increasing the age for that, but then getting rid of the distribution, being able to lengthen it for people inheriting IRAs. You know, if you inherit an IRA right now, they'll basically take your life expectancy. If you got a 30-year life expectancy, they take the account value, they divide it by 30. So you take, you know, 100,000, you divide it by 30, and you know, you got about $3,300 that has to come out of your IRA, right? And in essence, you can stretch out the IRA for a long period of time. Well, what if they, that's something they've been working on right now. That's out there to reduce that amount of time for you to stretch that, so that they get the tax revenue up more upfront. And, you know, you just got to be aware of these types of things when it comes to planning. You just have to. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show, right here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Not tonight. All right. You know what's interesting? I like talking about what's going on around the world, and just one of the things that I find fascinating is, you know, how aging populations affect economies. And you know, Japan really dealt with this. They don't have immigration, and because they don't have the immigration that other nations do, it's been an aging population. It's been a problem it's been a real problem for their economy for a long time. And one of the things that has helped America forever is that we have had immigration. Now, when that immigration is stymied to some extent, that can be a problem, you know, simply because, you know, people aren't having kids like they used to have. And, you know, this is an issue that gets a lot of people emotionally. You know, because, you know, we got to make sure it's legal. And, you know, true. You know, you got to make sure it's legal. I remember Alan Greenspan doing a cogent explanation of the type of immigration that he thought that we needed to have, which is, you know, getting people in the country that have good degrees, good education, good skills, you know, just simply because people like that end up not only paying their own way, but they create jobs, and that ends up being really good. Now, one of the things I do talk about as being one of the biggest sources of economic stimulus and making sure that an economy does well is the rule of law. And, you know, the reality of it is, if you have a company, if you have a company and you are not convinced that a country is going to make sure that your company's, that your rights to assets and your property, that you're going to be taken care of, then you won't move that company to that country. You just simply won't do it. And so on the risks of investing you have to think about with international investing is property rights protection, something that I've talked about before and talk about on many occasions. Is that something we look at when we're talking about emerging markets countries, for example? It's very, very important to look at the level of property rights protections. You know, what kind of treaties are there in place to protect people's rights to property? Very, very important. Well, there was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal this week. It was "Popular Protests Rattle Arab Leaders." Fascinating. And here's where this comes from for me. When I look at China and the dominance and the importance of a country like China, what is it that is so important about China to the rest of the world? Well, it's population. It's economy. It's the ability to actually buy things, and we have a whole group of people that they've embraced enough of capitalism. You know, they've embraced some capitalistic principles in order to get the level of success they have. Now, their level of success is nowhere near a fraction of America, but the level of success that they do have and the growth that they have has been as a result of taking capitalistic principles and applying them. You know, they allow some people to become rich, for example. You know, by allowing some people to become wealthy, by giving them some control, gives them incentive to work and do things because everybody does things in their own self-interest, right? Now, it says in Beirut, this is waves of sustained protests have shaken entrenched Arab rulers from Algeria to Iraq, injecting a new sense of euphoria among activists across the region as more leaders succumb to demands for change. Now, here you're looking, and here's my point about this, is that why is it we have areas around the world with corrupt governments, you know, in Africa? And we have places where there's so much corruption, but there is that human capital. There are people there that if they were just given the chance, they would be great consumers of products. They would love to buy and own the things that we in America have, the TVs and the computers and the phones and the cars and all of the stuff that we have. But they would love to live at the level that we do, but simply because of their government, they can't. And because of that, they are not a market for any of the companies here in the United States or, you know, other companies around the world because they can't buy the stuff. They don't have the economic means to do it. And whenever I see something like this, I go, this is kind of interesting. Let's see where it leads. There isn't a whole lot of talk about it, but I've watched this kind of stuff over the years, and it has led to some really interesting, you know, outcomes. United in their calls to end corruption. What did I say? This is the big deal to me. Corruption is the big deal. And kleptocracy. You know, what is that? You know, kleptocracy, well, it's just what it sounds like. Kleptomaniacs. They're in charge, right? They're stealing stuff. They're stealing natural resources. People come in, these rulers come in, and they steal natural resources, and they take money from people, and they take off with what's not rightfully theirs. Now, these demonstrators are fueling a new era of unrest that's defied violent crackdowns and politicians' appeals to stay home. Just stay home. Don't fight against us. Just stay home, will you? They're using lessons from the Arab Spring, maintaining a focus on reforms and trying to avoid the pitfalls that turned hopeful uprisings in Syria, Libya, and Yemen into civil wars. Latest to fall, Prime Minister Saad of Lebanon, the embattled son of a political dynasty, who agreed Tuesday to relinquish power in the face of nationwide anti-corruption protests over the past 2 weeks. And, Yeah, look at that and go, that's really, really interesting. Now, it said, while the Arab Spring was, further on in the article, says Arab Spring was largely defined by efforts to topple authoritarian rulers who used fear and intimidation to retain their grip on power, the continuing protests in Lebanon and Iraq are focused on demands for the end of endemic political corruption that has eroded confidence in their elected leaders. You know, so I mean, you have this kind of corruption. Who on earth wants to do business in a country with that kind of junk going on? Would you move your company over there knowing that, you know, they're going to come in and say, ooh, look at this. You know, Joe's plumbing. Let's go. Joe's doing some good work in the plumbing. Let's just take all this money. Let's find some. And this literally happens. No one's going to open a serious business if they think that the fruits of their labor are going to be just taken. And this can be the downside of overregulation. That's what we've got to be vigilant about, this regulation stuff, guys. When people come in and say, we're going to regulate. People, you know, we've got to regulate. Well, you know, I like regulation in one way and I hate it another way. You know, one thing that I find is that, you know, sometimes people can be taken advantage of when companies don't have any regulations, don't have any rules, and they don't have any bounds. You look at this. I was up in Chicago. And one of my son's friends was talking about how they had reversed the direction of the river. And I was like, oh, come again? He said, yeah, he was telling me the history of it, and they'd reversed the direction of the river. And people were dumping junk, the companies were dumping junk in, and what was happening is the junk is going into the lake. And, of course, people have to get their drinking water, and there's just junk in the lake, and it's polluted, and it's, you know, bad stuff, right? So what they do is they reverse the direction of the river, and they send it downstream to St. Louis, and they're not too happy about it. But it was really, really interesting how, you know, that these companies were just dumping things in there. And I says, yeah, I mean, that's one of those things you look at it. Somebody gets rich by just going, hey, you know what? It'd be like me going, you know what? I'm just going to throw my trash outside the door of my office and throw it all over the place, and somebody will pick it up. You have to have some regulation that says you can't go and do that kind of stuff. You can't, just because you're too lazy to carry it to a trash can, can't just dump it on the sidewalk outside. Kind of ridiculous to think of it that way, but that's really what we're talking about right here. Dump a bunch of junk into the river. We make a bunch of money selling whatever it is we sell, whatever chemical products we sell, but, you know, somebody else has to deal with cleaning it up, the general public. And there's a fairness issue there, and there's some regulation that has to be in place. So there's balance. Some people say, no, we don't need any regulation. No, that's nonsense. Now, you got mounds of rules that no one can stay completely abreast on, and that's the issue. So you got lots of rules out there, and what happens is they become too onerous, and no company can know all the rules that apply to their industry. And then what happens is, this is where regulation can go really wrong. Company gets caught breaking one of the rules, and then the government comes in and says, oh, you broke one of those rules. I didn't even know that was a rule. Well, guess what? You owe us this much money. Yeah, and they just come in and the government says, hey, we need money. Let's go and find some rule, some arcane rule that some company broke, and we can take money from them. You know, that literally happens, that level of corruption. And then the business, at what point do they just go, the heck with it? I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm out of this country. They quit. They shut down. Jobs are lost. And then when this is reversed, when they finally fix it like this, then commerce comes back. And, you know, sometimes this stuff goes through cycles, but it would be really nice if we don't go through the stupid cycle, wouldn't it be? Wouldn't that be a really good thing, not to go through a stupid cycle like that? Yeah, I think it'd be really good. But that's my opinion. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show. See, I just get off on these crazy tangents, don't I? Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show, right here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. And I was just reading something, thinking, is it literally? I wish I had more time to read this in between. I just in show prep, I wish I had seen this beforehand, because what I was just talking about, it just appears that there is a rule that the Supreme Court is weighing. I'm going to have to print this and actually check it out, because what I was literally just talking about, no joke, about the ability for companies to, or country, or governments, or countries, or state governments, or whatever, to come back and say, oh, you violated this little arcane rule, and we're going to come back and take a bunch of money from you. I think that what this article is actually saying, that there is actually a challenge to the ability to do that on a federal level on something. I'm not going to get into it right now because I may misspeak, but I think I'm going to check that out because, wow, how timely. Wall Street Journal just now. Adam Smith is revenge. This is interesting because I heard this being talked about during the week. Adam Smith, so Wealth of Nations. He wrote the book, The Wealth of Nations, and he talked a lot about how the free market was the best way to run an economy. And I often talk about this in terms of investing. Why is it so hard for people to get higher returns than the market? Beat the stock market, to not be able to time the market with any effect? Well, the reason has to do with the fact that information is factored into stock prices so darn quick, and it's so easy to trade on that information. So ease of information, ease of transaction is the reason that it is so hard to beat markets. And that's what Adam Smith said. And he says that's why we ought to let the free, the invisible hand in the free market run things. You know, for example, if you're selling something and your competitor is selling it for a lower price, I'm going to look at it and go, is it the same thing? You know, so I'll look at the information. Is it the same basic product? Is it the same quality? The same type of product? Are there any differences between them? And if there aren't any differences and one person's selling it for a whole lot more than the other person is, then by George, I'm going to go to the cheaper provider of the product, right? And that was the whole idea behind the Wealth of Nations, is, you know, let the economy figure it out, let the private industry. Now, sometimes it can be pretty complicated because the reality of it is some products aren't that easy to compare. And some things are just, you know, it's just too complicated for the average investor to really know all the variables and understand everything they need to know to make a good decision. So that can be a challenge. And then you take, you know, the market right now. Look at what's going on around the world right now on the internet. Anyway, it's like 60-70% or something like that of all reviews online of products are fake. And you just go, okay, so I'm try to gather information. Maybe I don't know everything I need to know, but I'm going to go look at people that have done or gotten the product and then taken the plunge, and I'm going to see how they like it. Did they like it? And then you go out and read reviews, and then you realize later on that you maybe read a whole bunch of reviews that were all fake and they're all made up. And then you say, well, I'm getting bad information. So it can be a challenge. But anyway, there are a lot of things that Adam Smith was just dead on right about. And we look at the experiment a couple hundred years later and we see that, yes, capitalism did work way better than socialism, way better than communism ever dreamt of working, right? Now, what's going on right now is this whole question about the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates, and it was the topic of conversation this week, and they covered it in the journal. It says, the great counterfactual of the Trump presidency is how much faster the economy would be growing without the damage of trade protectionism, you know, tariffs, in essence. And we look at it and say, well, there are a lot of reasons that we had the tariffs. We had to try to, you know, move some production from China to other countries, and you know, you can have all kinds of arguments regarding that. But there are people that say, well, you know, the thing is that the Federal Reserve is just lowering interest rates, and the reason they're doing it is because they want to stay competitive and blah, blah, blah. We want to stay competitive as a nation. But the reality of it is, and it's well documented in this article, is that when you have reductions in interest rates, it's not a great sign that the economy is just flaming hot. And the article says, President Trump and some in the White House blame the Federal Reserve and Europe for this slump. But neither explanation holds up. Europe hasn't grown fast for decades. Its 2017 growth bump was helped by faster U.S. growth. And that's why, you know, I was talking about earlier in the show, I said that's why markets over there are selling at such low levels. Remember I said that I'm not necessarily looking at U.S. markets and saying they're overpriced and those international markets selling that they're underpriced. No, they're properly priced because there's a lot of, you know, crazy stuff going on, and they're selling at a very, very low price. You got small value selling at 12 to 1 versus international small value at just over 9 to 1 in terms of price to earnings. And U.S. large companies selling at over $20 for every dollar of earnings. Well, why is the U.S. large selling for so much more? And it has to do with the fact that, the reality of it is those international markets have been hampered by a lot of the same kind of junk that we're talking about throwing around here. That's why I said it's really important that you stay diversified, because if we go the direction that they've gone, they're going to have the competitive advantage over there, really. Strong evidence is that trade policy is the main growth culprit related to slowing exports, slower China growth, and exports of U.S. farm, industrial, and construction equipment. And spending on information processing, much of which is exported, was the largest in 7 years. Study by the Federal Reserve economists this year looked at two waves of trade policy shock. First in 2018, the first half of 2019, estimated the impact reduced GDP growth had was by a percentage point. And the National Association for Business Economics October survey, 53% cited trade policy as the key downside economic risk through 2020. So the reduction in interest rates, they're very limited what they can do. The Fed does what they can. But the reality of it is, we've got to have, the taxes. A tariff is a hidden tax. And, what else do you do? I don't know. Good question. Been the struggle that this presidency's had. And, I stay diversified. Best advice I can give you. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show. This is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there. And if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Till next week, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.